program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
You are listening to the radio program, Let's Talk About It. Thanks for joining us today on this Global Peace Network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation. It is an honor to welcome you, all those who have joined us from many countries around the world, to listen to this illuminating discussion on inter-religious conflict resolution. I am your host, Basil Ogorji. Peace and blessings to you all. Before we begin our conversation on inter-religious conflict resolution, we would like to take a moment of silence to remember all the victims of religiously motivated violence and terrorism around the world. In a special way, we remember the victims of the June 12th mass shooting, the terrorist attack in Orlando, Florida, the terrorist attack that took about 49 people to their graves, and more than people were heavily injured and wounded. They're in the hospital right now trying to recover. We just want to use this opportunity to remember them for a few seconds.
We'll be right back.
This program is brought to you by ISERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.iSERMmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners and our esteemed guests, for today's important conversation on interreligious conflict resolution. We just took a few moments of silence to remember the victims of ethnic and religious conflict, ethnic and religious violence and terrorism that is occurring in many countries around the world. In a special way, we remember those in Orlando, those who were victims of the mass shooting that occurred recently. For today's discussion on interreligious conflict resolution, we have in our studio a renowned scholar in interreligious conflict resolution and interfaith dialogue, Dr. Muhammad Abunimar, a professor at the School of International Service, American University, and also he's a senior advisor at the King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz International Center for interreligious and intercultural dialogue at the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program. Professor Abunimar served as director of the Peace Building and Development Institute. He has conducted interreligious conflict resolution training and interfaith dialogue workshops in conflict areas around the world. He's also the founder of Salam Institute for Peace and Justice, an organization that focuses on capacity building, civic education, intrafaith, and interfaith dialogue. In addition to his numerous articles and many publications, Dr. Abunimar is the co-founder and co-editor of the Journal of Peace Building and Development. We are ignited and excited to have Dr. Muhammad Abunimar on the ISERM radio program. Let's talk about it. Dr. Abunimar, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you also for inviting me. This is an honor to be with you, and I look forward for our conversation.
Wonderful. I hope it's just going to be an interesting conversation, an enriching conversation on the very topic that we carry in our hearts. Mm-hmm. And to you, our listeners, and all those who have called in to ask questions or add their voice to the conversation, once again, I welcome you to this important discussion. I want you to relax and make yourself comfortable. This is going to be a public dialogue. So feel free to call into the show, add your voice to the conversation, and make your views known to the world. The number to call is 323-642-1236. Again, to ask question or add your voice to the conversation, call 323-642-1236. If you are outside the United States, you must dial 1 before 323-642-1236. Dr. Muhammad Abunimar, let me once again welcome you to this platform, the ISERM radio program. Let's talk about it. We are happy that you have joined us today on the ISERM radio program. You are a professor at the School of International Service, American University, and a senior advisor at the King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz International Center for Interreligious and Intercultural Dialogue. You are also the founder of Salaam Institute for Peace and Justice, having published a lot of books in this field and done a lot of research. Could you briefly tell us and our listeners what the King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz International Center for Interreligious and Intercultural Dialogue does, as well as what you do at the Salaam Institute for Peace and Justice?
Thank you. The Kaiser Center in Vienna is a unique entity, an organization that was created by four governments. So it is an intergovernmental organization created by Spain, Austria, Saudi Arabia, and the Vatican. And there are other countries who will be joining in the next year or two, and they are in the process of applying and joining the center. So it's an intergovernmental organization like UNESCO, like ESCO, like a number of other intergovernmental global organizations. At the same time, it is also governed by the five major religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And the five major faith groups are represented as an institution. From each one of them, there is a number of representatives. So this interplay between politics, policy making, and religious institution is the unique part, and it was created really to try and bridge the gap between those two stakeholders, I would say, mainly to explore what positive and constructive role can religious institutions and leaders play and contribute in responding to global conflicts, global challenges, and social political problems that the world is facing, especially in area where religious identity is being manipulated by politicians or by religious leaders in a conflict like Central African Republic, Nigeria, Myanmar, or the Middle East in general, the Arab world. And these are the four areas that the center focus on, how religious leaders can play a role, a positive role in promoting peace and reconciliation.
That's a wonderful, a great initiative that honestly is very timely. It's actually very timely because of the number of cases, religious conflicts and war that we experience in this contemporary era in the 21st century, and the many countries that this very center is really has invested its resources and skills and talents in mobilizing people who are experts in this area. It is actually very phenomenal because those countries are really in need of all that. I want to ask you if you could share with our listeners what you do at the Salaam Institute for Peace and Justice.
Yeah, and the Salaam Institute is a non-profit organization that we've created, launched back in 2003, and it focuses on, again, the possibilities for dialogue, for education, for linking peace and development in a way in which local communities and local stakeholders have a sense of ownership and sense of a say in the program that's being implemented. And it was created primarily launched for a couple of reasons. One of them is that many times I've noticed with many of my colleagues working in areas where there is a need for people to be versed into the cultural and religious identity of the participants, or have the knowledge of the context, kind of the insider mediator approach. where you need the knowledge of the culture, the knowledge of the religion, in order for you to be able to maneuver and the local complexity and be able to connect with participants and really design a program for peace building that truly respond to the needs of this individual. In addition, there was in 2003, major lack in emphasis on Islam and peace, Islam and dialogue, Islam and nonviolence. So Salam Institute came to respond to that need, in which practitioners, scholars from Muslim background will develop educational research material as well as a training material in the area of Islamic peace and Islam and pluralism, Islam and diversity. And as a result, a number of interesting programs were developed domestically here in the U.S. We launched the first dialogue between evangelical communities and Muslim communities in five different cities, with a manual produced between 2004 and 2007. In addition, we've started one of the few and initially training of imams and Quranic school teachers, madrasas, in Niger, Chad, Burkina Faso, Erbil, Iraq, Kurdistan, as well as Egypt and Pakistan. And in a number of these countries, we've developed localized material to try and bring the voices of the moderate Muslims in these communities to be the main, to be the primary voice and to be the primary discourse that people hear. And we thought that imams and religious leaders in the community ought to be empowered and build their capacity to make initiatives, local initiatives. And that's what Salam has done in many ways. Finally, there is another project that we have launched about 5 years ago on forgiveness and reconciliation in the Arab world. And we've done solid research with surveys and interviews, as well as content analysis of documents that exist, where we collected the stories of forgiveness. And we conducted training in Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, and Iraq on that topic.
Phenomenal. These are very important initiatives that you have really, you're working on, especially in the Middle East. What you're doing is to explore and empower the middle rangers, those who are the leaders in those communities, community leaders, religious leaders who are local, to be able to be in charge of the conflict resolution processes and systems in their own countries. And I just want to kind of make a remark to something very important that occurred. Of course, you as a researcher and a scholar, you are aware of this, that since the end of the Cold War, some scholars have argued that there is a significant shift in the nature, dynamics, patterns of conflicts. And in his book, Building Peace, Sustainable Reconciliation in Divided Societies, which was published in 1997, John Paul Lederach predicted that there is a shift from international conflicts to intranational conflicts. And according to him, ethnicity and religion are very important factors that we should honestly pay attention to. And the causes of these international ethno-religious conflicts could be based on the fact that the fundamental needs are not addressed and space for participation in decisions not provided, equitable distribution of resources and benefits not provided, competition and comparison continue to surface in those regions and leading to some kind of escalation of conflict somehow. Now, the outcome becomes the fact that identification with a group becomes attractive. Now, and there is also the question of history and memory, which creates a vacuum for the protractability and intractability of the religious and sectarian conflicts that we see around the world, especially in those countries that you have just mentioned. Now, my question to you is, why is history and memory important in understanding religious conflicts? How would you describe the nature, dynamics, and patterns of religious conflicts?
Well, that's an interesting question, particularly in this period of time where we see in many parts of the world today more emphasis on the what we call identity-based conflict. And identity-based conflict is a concept in the field of peace and conflict resolution that refers to the to the parties in the conflict who utilize different features of their identity in order to escalate or de-escalate the conflict. So if we take a religiously motivated conflict or religiously manipulated conflict, like the one in Iraq or the one in Syria in many ways, as well as in Central African Republic, we see that the religious identity of the individuals who, particularly leaders, whether they are politicians or they are religious actors, have been deployed in the conflict. So they use the scripture, they use the rituals, they use symbols of the faith in order to mobilize people to engage in violence against other groups who they deem or defined as outsider, or they define them as inferior, as in Central African Republic or in Myanmar, where in those two cases Muslims are being defined as the inferior, and in one Buddhist, some Buddhist monks, religious leaders, have unfortunately fallen into that trap of using religious identity to incite violence. And also in Central African Republic, similar acts are done by certain Christian leaders or certain members of the Christian community against whoever remained as a Muslim community in Central African Republic. And it's exact same dynamic that takes place between Shia and Sunni in Syria, or between the different religious groups, paramilitia group that fighting in Syria, where the Islamic identity and rituals and symbols and the very small differences that exist between Shia and Sunni are deployed into the battle through the flags, through the reciting of the Quran, through the visiting the history of Islam and Muslim, and pulling out of the history from the collective memory specific incidents to justify their quest for power and the quest for resources. That's why your question about collective memory and religious identity is crucial, because unfortunately many people are under the impression that the history of religion is a history of war and competition and history of violence. One should not deny that there are events of violence and competition between different faith groups. But at the same time, history is full of examples of cooperation, living together, coexistence, reconciliation, helping the poor and service to the needy, that done by Muslim, Christian, Jews, as well Buddhists and Hindus. And our work in Kaisid and in other areas, we try to shift the orientation of people to see the history of religion, not only history of competition and war, but to recognize that religious identity can be source of peace, reconciliation, and could be a source of cooperation. Because as you mentioned, John Paul Lederach, our colleague, book from the 90s, but even before that, the religious identity cannot be ignored and cannot be denied. We have to address it. We have to deal with it. Otherwise, as you said, the basic human need for identity will produce deprivation, and deprivation will produce frustration, which can lead to violence. The Soviet Union tried to, for 70 years, to deny the right of its communities to practice their religion, which I think was a major mistake, and it did not work. And I think the same thing in the Western capitalist system, where the religious identity was suppressed for centuries now, and now it's coming back, and religious leaders demanding more and more to be part of the negotiation table and part of the solving the problems.
Wonderful. And these are very, very important important points that you've raised. You raised on this very complex and complicated situation, conflict situation in many countries as we experience them today. Now, many people are wondering why religious conflicts are highly intractable. And there is honestly a growing concern and discussion around the implications of such religious teachings, like the law of retaliation, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, strike back, get even, do unto others like they do to you. And often these are honestly the things that underlie the kind of violence that we experience in many countries. And then it becomes a kind of mutual causation that even, make the conflict escalate the more, and not even the issues themselves. My question is, in what ways do you think the laws of retaliation, what the Latin people call lex talionis, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, in what ways have these contributed in the escalation and exacerbation of religious, sectarian, and faith-based conflicts? What do you think are the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim perspectives on war?
It's an interesting question, and the framing of it, I think. I see it quite the opposite, because I think most, if not all, faith groups and teaching of religion came to put a stop to the cycle of retaliation and revenge, or for an eye for an eye. At least I know very well from Islam that forgiveness and mercy and compassion in dealing with those who you have difference with or conflict with are the norms rather than the exception. And in Christianity, similarly, Christ, peace be upon him, came with one single message of peace and mercy rather than retaliation or revenge. Buddhism, definitely, and Hinduism, many of the gods preach the value of love. And based on this, Mahatma Gandhi in the 30s established the whole nonviolence school or nonviolence thought and the practice based on the concept of satyagraha. Judaism also follows or teaches the same value, mercy and as well as a compassion to the other, and peace, shalom and the salam are the greetings in those religions. In fact, I think tribal communities prior to those Abrahamic religion suffered from the disease of the retaliation and revenge. And unfortunately, in many places where these three faith groups were spread, they struggled in overcoming this tribal tradition of retaliation. So I tend to look at it exactly the opposite. Religion comes to prevent and prohibit a cycle of violence of 100 years or 30 years or 40 years, despite that Christian, Muslim, and Jews have engaged in it since at least, you know, in the even before the Middle Ages, for long wars and battles. We can do that by focusing on those positive values and positive resources in the faith group as well. I'm not sure if I clarified the concept here, but I'm trying to say briefly that retaliation and revenge are stranger to the faith groups and to the religion rather than as the norm or the mainstream. Tribal tradition, tribal society prior to the Abrahamic and prior to the Buddhist and Hindu were more obsessed and more followed this norm of eye for an eye or for revenge. And we know that this is usually fueled by economic, with fueled by political incentives, and that individual always will pursue their self-interest, and we need to be in cooperation with individuals and others, especially those who are different from us. Our disease today stems from the fear of the other, the lack of knowing the other, the lack of space, especially in intractable conflict like in Iraq or in Syria or in Israel-Palestine, where even in Ireland and Cyprus and in number of other conflict area in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the space to get to know those who are different from us in these countries, in these societies, is so limited. So the interaction with the other is always through distrust, through fear and antagonism, and that's what continuously feed the intractability of the conflict. So the way to break it is to get to know more, is get to interact with the other in a more trustful relationship. Sorry for the long answer.
Oh, no, this is highly needed to clarify that the an eye for an eye, that law precedes religion, the formal religious moral codes that we have today. It's very important. I'm going to be bringing you back to religion and culture later in this very program, so we can maybe expatiate and clarify a little bit. But again, there are various notions when it comes to religion, diversity, and identity. I think these are very important concepts when it comes to do with interreligious conflict resolution and also interfaith or even intrafaith dialogue. The idea of diversity, identity, all these influence the outcome of interreligious conflict resolution. So my question on this is, what are the various perspectives on religious diversity and identity from the holy books, for instance, the Torah, the Bible, the Quran? So are there different perspectives on identity, diversity that each of these holy books hold have stipulated, or do they have a very generic perspective on identity, diversity? How can we understand these concepts from the holy books?
Yeah, that's a very challenging question, and I think complicated in a number of ways. I am not specialized in Christian or Jewish or even Buddhist or Hindu or even most Islamic theology. However, from the limited knowledge I have through the 20 or 25 years of interfaith dialogue and intrafaith dialogue, I can assure you that I have never heard one religious person saying that my faith opposes diversity. Diversity in the sense of acknowledging the fact that people are different in their dress, in their food, in their music, in their ways of living, style of living, in their preferences, and people are different in their values. Differences are not questioned, and diversity is not questioned. What usually is questioned is the ways in which we go about managing this diversity. For example, in Islam, we know as a basic, as an axiomatic principle that God created human as diverse in order for them to get to know each other. And the concept in the Quran is called لِتَعَارَفُ, for people to know each other. And in Christianity, similarly, as well as in Judaism and Buddhism, this notion of diversity exists, and there is no expectation that people should be all the same, or they all should follow the same exact ways of living and ways of expressing their preferences. Where the conflict is also is not only in managing that diversity, meaning who gets to get the prominency in the society. If you have a $100 budget for the country, how this gets divided to ensure that people can worship, people can build their mosques, people can build their churches and synagogues and temples in a free and safe way. That's the management of the diversity challenge. And unfortunately, in many parts of the history of a human so far, one religious group, doesn't matter which one, tried to impose their ways of managing the diversity. The Ottoman Empire came up with the system of Millah, where they gave some autonomy to Christians and Jews and others underneath them. Other forms of governance proposed other aspects. The Muslim Sharia laws in number of countries today, they have one way of managing diversity. Western cultural governance in Europe and America and Canada have proposed another system to manage religious diversity. And I think we all experimenting in those diversity management system. And we have not come to a system where we would say, yes, this is the perfect system that fits all human, or culture, and all religion. But briefly, diversity and religious diversity is a core value in most of the religions. The second challenge that we have is that the notion of conversion historically, up to the 20th century, if not even today, there are still Muslim and Christian, particularly Muslim and Christian, who are actively trying to convert people to their faith. And not convert in the, let's say, peaceful way, free way, but in some areas around the world, only in some areas around the world, the competition on conversion and da'wah has produced tension and distrust in that area. But this is, I think, minimal, considering and comparing to what was going on between the different religious groups in the 19th century or in the 17th century when European invaded Latin America and converted everybody into Catholicism or Protestant, Evangelical or Muslim, reached Africa and converted also other. This massive wave of conversion, I think human history is not seeing at this point. And what we are seeing is a struggle in finding a system of a religious diversity management that fits the 21st century, where people religious dignity is respected and preserved. And I think that's something we all need to keep in mind and aspire to reach it, rather than revert back to 200 or 300 years ago when the norm was impose your faith on other because you have the truth and they don't have any form of truth.
And that was a very big problem in those days. Many missionaries, especially those who went to Africa, South America, even Asia, many traditional worshippers were forced to abandon their religions, and they were forcefully baptized and given different names that they do not actually understand. And when many of them, especially in Christianity in those days, wanted to get baptized with their native names, they were told that those native names were evil, and they were given new names, which were mostly names that are a little bit strange. But again, this is a very huge topic and area for discussion. But it boils down to the idea of interpretation, hermeneutic, understanding that very reality, that being, understanding God in different perspectives. And I think this is actually the basic factor when it comes to interreligious conflicts or interreligious violence. How do we comprehend? The questions that emerge are we actually worshiping the same God? Are Jewish people, Christians, Muslims, and believers of other religions worshiping the one and the same God, or are they worshiping different gods? I just want to bring this question to you, Dr. Abunimar, because a lot of people have been asking, many people who are working in the area of interfaith dialogue are faced with some of these questions. Are different religions worshiping the same God? Is the difference does the difference have to do with our interpretation of that very being? And so is that the basis for the misunderstandings, our perception of that God and perceptions of other human beings?
Yeah, and again, this is another theological question. And we tend, in many parts of our interfaith dialogue, whether it is in Qaysid or Salam or outside, we do not put these questions on the table, because this type of discussion about the nature of God and the way we perceive God or the God is something highly complex and require people knowledge, deep knowledge of their own faith and their own scripture and their own history, and also it require a deeper understanding of the other, how other faiths make this hermeneutics or interpretation. So even if you are a very good Muslim and you're a scholar and you have studied for 100 years your own faith, still you need to know the other faith group and the other ways how they make interpretation of their gods and their word of their gods in order for you to make the comparison. So again, we tend not to engage in that. What we focus on, as I said earlier, is the implication of the fact that we worship differently and we require different structures different mechanisms to express the religious identity, and those differences, or what we call religious diversity, require a system of management that ensure if you are a Buddhist and you're living in Scotland, that you have access from the public resources and you have access from the government of Scotland to give you the right to worship what you think is the right way, and not for the government of Scotland to impose on you their views of the nature of God, because no Christian, no Muslim, no Jewish, and no Buddhist or Hindu can claim that they 100% know the nature of their God perfectly. That's already an assumption in all faith groups. Human knowledge of God is limited. What we do is we make interpretation, and therefore, if it is a human interpretation, it is subject to mistakes. It's subject to errors. The principle that interests us in this conversation is to ensure that we respect each other. We respect each other's right to define our own God, to define the nature of our own God, without passing a value judgment on other people's definition by saying it is bad definition, wrong definition, or lower or higher definition. And therefore, if I think it's wrong, I have the capacity to go and correct it, or the capacity to go, or the right to go and mend it, or show them the light. And these are the type of interpretation that have drove us as a human to kill each other for thousands of years, and continue, unfortunately, to fuel the zealousy and the fanaticism and fundamentalism that we see it in some, and not all, in very small minority in this faith group. The majority of people who belong to this faith group are peaceful. They go about worshiping their gods on daily basis without necessarily interfering or imposing on other groups.
Wonderful. And listeners, those who are listening to this important discussion on interreligious conflict resolution, those who are on our website, those who are listening on other platforms and channels where we are broadcasting this conversation live, we opened our chat box so you can send in your questions. And if you want to make a contribution, please do signal, send us a signal, and we're going to ask our guest, Dr. Abnehmer, your questions, and he's here with us in our studio responding to these very important questions that have to do with interreligious conflict resolution, intrafaith dialogue. We're going to be taking a short break right now. When we come back, we will be looking at intrafaith dialogue. What exactly is interfaith dialogue? There are different usage of that very word, interfaith dialogue. Many people are calling it interfaith cooperation, interfaith action. A lot of university programs, master's programs have opened up. People are enrolling and studying interfaith dialogue, interfaith action, interfaith cooperation. Are we talking about the same things? What are the processes and the systems? How could we make interfaith dialogue sustainable in divided societies?
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, and the esteemed guest, Dr. Abnehmer from the American University, who is an expert on interfaith dialogue. Dr. Abnehmer, because of the intractable nature of religious conflicts, there seems to be a growing awareness about the importance of dialogue around the world. Interreligious dialogue is gradually developing, not only as an academic discipline, but also as a conflict resolution practice. And many scholars and practitioners have used different terms like interfaith action, interfaith communication, interreligious cooperation, and so on, to explain the same discipline and practice. Unfortunately, many policymakers and the public, including the media, are ignorant of the importance of interfaith dialogue. Now, in your book, Peace Building by Between and Beyond Muslims and Evangelical Christians, a book published by Lexington Books, published in 2010, now you said, and I quote, when evangelical Christian and Muslim scholars meet to dialogue, to explore the interface between their perspectives and to deepen the shared understandings, common resources and relationships, they discover that they have much to talk about. There is much that is shared in common. Both take the scripture seriously. Both care deeply about peacemaking. Both believe that it is God's will that we work for justice for all. Both believe in the power of prayer, and there are differences. True dialogue does not seek to avoid or evade differences. Openness to conversation and firmness in belief are both necessary to meaningful dialogue. My question to you, Dr. Abunima, is, based on your research findings and practice, what is interfaith dialogue as a system and as a process, and how is it different or similar to intrafaith dialogue?
We teach courses on that for the whole semester, trying to define it. So whatever I'm going to say is going to be limited and insufficient in that thing. But a couple of features what distinguish interfaith from intrafaith is basically the audience and the themes maybe one can discuss in that setting. Regardless, though, we know intrafaith dialogue is a conversation between people who belong to the same faith group. And these conversations are very challenging to conduct and very challenging to facilitate than the interfaith, where people from different faith groups, and the ecumenical conversation in Christianity has hundreds of years of roots of conversation between different groups of Christianity. In Islam, between Shia and Sunni, or between Sufi, Sunni, and Shia group, or between Ismaili and others, or between Baha'i and Shia and Sunni. These type of conversations are essential to take place today, because in many ways, many of the religiously based conflicts are fueled by those minor differences. The processes in both of them, in the intrafaith and interfaith, rely on the principle that you quoted from that 2010 book. It's the assumption that we have over 90, if not 95% similarities in values, in many ways, in motivation why people worship certain, in certain ways. Humans are very similar in many ways that they interact with each other or conduct their business. Unfortunately, in a conflict situation, we select minor differences. Whether you put your left hand or right hand while you're praying, or whether you recite the Quran, a Quranic verse, four times or five times, and some other minor differences in the ritual, or whether you take communion or don't take communion, right? Or the way you carry your cross, or the way you observe Sabbath in the Jewish community. These small differences, we exaggerate them, and we over-focus on them in a way to distinguish ourselves from the other group. But we don't stop there. What we do, we attribute a value judgment, negative one, to say because you worship different than me, then you are lost or you don't know your path, you're not right, you're not correct, you're not going to be saved, you're not going to go to heaven, you will go to hell, you're not a true faithful or a believer. These type of accusation and labeling of the other who worship different from us is the focus of the interfaith and intrafaith conversation, where we discover usually after 2 days living together in a trustful setting and context, people discover that they are exactly like them. They are similar in many ways and more than they expected. And that's usually the source of surprise, to discover that between Shia and Sunni, there are very few and minor differences, and the majority are similarities and commonalities, and they should be celebrated, and they should be acknowledged and recognized. And based on that, groups in intrafaith or interfaith who make such a discovery, based on that, they develop common projects, action, cooperation. And through the action and cooperation, they cement their relationship, the new relationship, a relationship that was based before on the assumption that people are very different and they are antagonistic against us, to a new transformed relationship that is based on the assumption that they are very similar to us, there are more commonalities between us and them, and therefore we can work on especially issues that will help us reach a satisfactory system of religious diversity, and we can manage that diversity in a satisfactory way. That's the purpose of interfaith and intrafaith dialogue, is to move the conversation from antagonism, suspicion, distrust into a relationship based on knowledge of commonalities, recognizing some differences, and building common collaborative relationships.
These are wonderful ideas, and I just want to thank you so much for making this distinction and letting our listeners know the difference between interfaith dialogue, faith dialogue, how both of them are very essential in moving the conversation forward and creating space for collaboration and mutual understanding. Now, in the media, especially the Western media, is saturated with some kind of assumptions that you try to clarify in 2003. Of course, it seems a lot of people are not even reading because some of the assumptions, false assumptions that are being put out there have already been debunked, clarified in books, in some literary works, through research and scholarly findings. But again, those would depend on propagandists do not have time to really go into research. There is actually this kind of idea, notion that some religions are inherently violent. And we see that play out in the media, even in the political rallies and campaigns here in the United States and many other countries, because of instances of terrorist attacks. And there is a kind of an overgeneralization and demonization of a particular religion. In your book, Nonviolence and Peace Building in Islam, Theory and Practice, which actually is the first edition published by University Press of Florida in 2003, you examined largely unexplored theme of nonviolence and peace building in Islamic religion, tradition, and culture. And after comprehensively reviewing the existing studies on this topic, you present solid evidence for the existence of principles and values in the Quran, Hadith, and Islamic tradition that support the application of nonviolence and peace building strategies in resolving disputes. So that means these principles are inherent. Principles of nonviolence are actually inherent in Islam. They are there in the Quran, in Hadith, and also in the Islamic tradition. Now, would you be kind, Dr. Abunima, to share with us and our listeners, those who are listening to this conversation? We know people want to ask some questions right now, but after this, after your response to this very question, we're going to take a question, maybe one person who is from one of the people who is there. We're going to take that question. But would you be kind to share with us and our listeners these principles and values in Quran, Hadith, and Islamic tradition that support the application of nonviolence and peace building strategies in resolving disputes, especially religious and political conflicts?
Sure. Thank you for your question and review of the book in 2003, which was, I think, one of the first research on that topic empirically as well as theoretically. Again, the set of principles and values that support nonviolent resistance and support peace building in Islam are known to every Muslim who grew up in a Muslim community and read the Quran and listened to the Hadith, as well as listened to the every Friday khutbah or sermon of the Friday sermon. They has to do with, again, with mercy. They has to do with justice. They has to do with the notion of individual responsibility. Each individual is responsible for his or her actions and deed. The other major principle in Islamic teaching has to do with good deeds. Amalul khair is that people are, or followers of the faith are expected to engage in good actions, good deeds, to help people, to help poor, to help the needy, and do their commitment to the society and the community. And these are essential value, including the value of patience, sabr. To be patient, there are so many stories and examples told in the Quran to Muslims to be patient in their reaction when they're angry, when they're frustrated, or when they differ in their views with other people, or when they are tested by their God, to be patient. And as we know, patience was the core of the discipline of Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Mother Teresa and many of the peacemakers, and also of Christ and many of the prophets and the peacemakers relied on the quality of patience. And that's a core concept, core value in Islam. The concept of Ummah, even that collective community, the solidarity among of people of the same faith and among human solidarity is also emphasized in the Quranic teaching and in the values in Islam. The notion of diversity is so central in the faith. And what I did, I took all of these values and basically posed one question to say, if all of these values exist in the theology as well as in the history of the practice during the Prophet, peace be upon him, time in Mecca and Medina, then we definitely have a solid ground to establish and construct our modern time theory, Islamic theory of nonviolence and peace building. So there is no shortage of it. And I'm sure Islam is not exception. Christianity, mm-hmm. Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, as faith group, they have all these values as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Abunima. We have a caller on the line who is calling from abroad. We just want to bring him on the air so he can quickly ask this question before we turn to other callers. Please, can you ask your question to our guest, Dr. Abunima?
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Abunima. We have a caller on the line who's calling from abroad. We just want to bring him on the air so he can speak here.
It seems there is a network problem where the caller is. The caller left his the window open, and it's kind of what we were saying was echoing. So if you can close the window of your browser, close the browser, then we're not going to be getting those echoes. So please try to close your browser before you ask your question. Now, we're going to be coming back to you within some minutes. Just be patient. Close your browser before you ask your questions. Dr. Abunima, there is something very important that we in this field think needs to be addressed in a discussion on interreligious conflict resolution. And this is the idea of sustainable reconciliation. Reconciliation, you have mentioned it as one of the principles, one of the needed in interfaith dialogue, even in intrafaith dialogue, to reconcile divided parties, societies or groups in conflict. But again, your colleague, John Paul Lederach, I mean, again, in your books, you have highlighted some of these as well. But in building peace, sustainable reconciliation in divided societies, he proposed a paradigm shift in conflict or peace intervention. And he believes that we should shift our focus from a concern with a resolution of issues toward a frame of reference that focuses on the restoration and rebuilding of relationships on the one hand, and a shift from a mechanical strategy, which often is referred to as the statist diplomacy that the governments use in trying to resolve ethnic, religious conflicts, which are highly intractable, and most often they do not actually work most of the time. Now, but again, there is this need to shift from this mechanical strategy to reconciliation as a central component of peace building. There are three assumptions that most scholars have really put forward to conceptualize reconciliation. One is relationship, point of encounter, which is a meeting place, which is very important in interfaith dialogue, and innovation or creativity. But again, this meeting place is of particular interest to us in this discussion. A point of encounter or a meeting place for people, people who have who are in dispute, who are in conflict, enemies who are fighting, for instance, in Syria, the different groups are in Iraq, or in Nigeria with Boko Haram, or even the Niger Delta people, in Central African Republic, where you have the Christians and Muslims, or even in Burundi. In Burundi, it was very chaotic recently because of ethnic conflicts. They need a meeting place, a point of encounter where these groups can come together, where issues can come together to confront each other, positions, interests, needs, even where healing, emotional trauma, grieve, where they can grieve, where they can exhaust their anger, pain, fears, and where memories of the past and the present can actually meet. So that meeting place is of great importance. And again, that meeting place, as your colleague said, is the place called the reconciliation, where truth and mercy meet together, and where justice and peace kiss, which is from the biblical Psalms, Psalm 85, says truth and mercy have met together, peace and justice have kissed. My question to you, Dr. Abunima, is how would you describe the importance and significance of a meeting space, a place? How could we create this meeting space? And again, what are the importance of truth and mercy, justice and peace during interfaith dialogue that occurs in that particular place?
Thank you again for this question, which again is the core of the field of peace building and reconciliation. The place, the meeting place, I look at it to both physically. It's very difficult to find a meeting point, meeting place in many of the conflict area. Even the physical meeting becomes very complicated and very challenging to secure it. But once you secure that meeting place, you need to create a safety net. Safety net for the participants to detach from their daily threats, daily risks, daily concerns, and get into the exploration, self-exploration, intra-faith exploration, and intra-ethnic exploration to ask the question, what can I do in order to build relationships with my enemy, with my opponent, in a different way? That require a unique space, and that's, I think, the meeting point we're talking about it. Now, the challenge is that when you use terminology like mercy, truth, and justice, and those terms are derived from religious connotation and the spiritual connotation. Many times the people we work with are not necessarily spiritual or religious, so they are interested in reaching an agreement. They're interested in the mechanics of negotiating a deal. And hence the critique of many of the political agreements that we reach, that they tend to last for 2, 3, 5, 10 years, and they will usually collapse after that. They're not sustained. So here was the critique that we need a different approach, a different paradigm to operate as a human. And that basically come with the theory of conflict resolution from the mid-80s, and then John Paul and others also, myself, have written about the need for conflict transformation. And that meeting place is what we call the conflict transformative framework, where we assume that a true reconciliation requires people to engage from within themselves, to look inside and tackle their own personal values, regardless if they are religious or non-religious. A secular human rights or secular civil society person have also set of values. So we encourage them to look at the importance of the relationship with the other and deal with these values. And they're essential to have in that safe place, in that meeting point. If you do not have a value conversation in the meeting place, value conversation about peace, about mercy, about truth, about justice, then you basically end up exchanging a product. You end up constructing a deal or an agreement that is dividing the resources or the land, the oil, the power for temporary time, and then the commitment is not there to sustain it, and therefore the conflict will come back. So it is crucial to have those values in the reconciliation conversation.
Wonderful. And I want to thank you so much for your input to these very important questions that we are honestly reflecting on. We have some questions in our chat box. And again, we have some callers who are here who want to ask some questions. And some of our callers are having difficulty.
Yeah, I'm happy to take them.
All right. So we have one question that one of our listeners sent to us to ask you. And the question says, there are polarized societies, and it's often difficult to resolve conflicts in polarized, highly polarized societies. What are the challenges that you experienced as a practitioner and as a scholar in those societies that are highly polarized?
But there are a number of challenges. One of them I have mentioned earlier. When you have a polarized society, it is so polarized that the society have decided to eliminate meeting points, meeting places. So one of the major challenges today, for example, for Israeli and Palestinians is to meet in Israel-Palestine, is to meet in a safe and trust place. So you have to arrange for leaving, arrange for other opportunities outside. Similarly for Cyprus, similarly for Niger and in some areas in the Boko Haram particularly, or in Central African Republic. In Myanmar, you cannot. So in these intractable places, in polarized society, the meeting place is so valuable and so rare. Another challenge for polarization is the illusion and the impression and misperception that people, it is normal to live this way. So this habituated system of conflict have influenced the youngest and the oldest by thinking that this is the normal way to live rather than the abnormal. And to break that normalcy is a very challenging part in the polarization. Another major challenge, a third one on the top here, it's the issue of the risk that many local peacemakers take. And many of those local peacemakers are really, in this conflict area, are really sacrificing their family, their life, their money, their efforts, and their resources with very little support from government, if not the opposite. Governments call them traitors. Governments oppose them, and many of the politicians and policymakers do not provide them with support. So the main challenge is to provide the genuine support to these pioneers and those risk takers in these societies.
Mm. And we have a student from the Nova Southeastern University in Florida who has just sent a question on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the question says, which model of interfaith dialogue has worked or could work in Israel and Palestine?
Well, in Israel and Palestine, there have been many experiments with the interfaith dialogue from the 1970s and 80s and 90s. And again, unfortunately, in Israel-Palestine, there's a very limited stories of success. However, there are examples one can talk about that. They're limited because the field of intra and interfaith dialogue is weak, in my view, in Israel-Palestine. And the people, the organizations who work in this area are in need for major support, capacity building, as well as, I think, definitely, how do I say, I think capacity building is very important aspect for many of these organizations to overcome their own limiting ideological orientation. But there are rabbis for human rights who work for advocacy. There is a center called Sabil Center that used to be in Bethlehem and Bejala. Both of them work for using religious identity to advocate for justice and preserving human rights views. There are women dialogue groups in Jerusalem that was experimented with in the mid-2000. There are many personal stories of relationship between Muslim, Christian, and Jews in the Holy Land, that people manage to sustain their individual relationships, build family relationships, visiting each other, and despite the conflict, they continue the relationship and their work for peace. But if success is defined as interfaith dialogue helping to resolve the political conflict, I'm afraid we do not have many empirical evidence to show that these interfaith experiments have contributed to that. We have more evidence on the advocacy part, where religious leaders, religious institutions who work for advocacy and the human rights have made contribution to in that direction.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Abunima. We have many questions here. This question I have to ask you because I think is very important from Johnson from UK, a student in UK, who is asking, Egypt has experienced a lot of sectarian conflicts, religiously and politically motivated revolution, and a lot of religious violence against the religious minorities. Has there been any attempt to initiate a justice and reconciliation program, just as it was done in South Africa?
Well, I've worked over 20 years now in Egypt, I am familiar with several initiatives on interfaith, intercultural dialogue. I can give the caller a website for the FID, the Forum for Intercultural Dialogue, that is hosted and run by CEOS, the Coptic Evangelical Community Service organization, which is the largest development faith-based development agency in Egypt. And they have been running over 20 years, 25 years, a very successful dialogue program where they brought thousands of Christian and Muslim Copts and Muslims managed to establish relationship, local initiative, and really contribute to sustaining peace in many of the small communities and local communities. It is always going to be clashes and the people who will unfortunately be ignorant and be fooled by their religious manipulation of their religious identity. But looking at the bright side of the picture, Egyptian society have always adopted the principle that Christians and Muslims in Egypt are citizens, are people who live together peacefully and coexistently. And despite the 6 years of upheaval that happened there, relatively speaking, compared to Iraq, compared to Syria, compared to Yemen, there is very limited and little success destroying the social and religious fabric of coexistence between Muslim and Christian. And I think many of these individuals who work in these programs are really heroes who stand very clearly against the polarization, against manipulation of that identity. Truth and reconciliation commissions like South Africa are not necessarily a priority or needed in the Egyptian context. Maybe they needed in Iraq, they needed in Yemen, they needed maybe in Libya, they needed in Syria. However, in the Egyptian scene, we will be really mischaracterizing the situation if we talk about TRC there. But reconciliation is needed on the local community, and efforts are being invested in that area.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Abunima. And we're going to be taking a short break, and I will ask you the very last question once we return from this very short break. And the question will have to do with religion, culture, and human rights. Just one question based on your publication on this very topic. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we listen to Professor Abunima on religion, culture, and human rights.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, and to you, our esteemed guest, for today's important discussion on interreligious conflict resolution, Professor Abu Nimer from the American University here in the United States of America. In your book, Contemporary Islam, Dynamic, Not Static, a book published by Routledge, new edition was published in 2006. You underscore the fact that contemporary Islam provides a counterweight to the prevailing opinions of Islamic thought as conservative and static, with a preference for violence over dialogue. Now, your book presents a progressive outlook for Islam's role in modern politics and society. It is actually a tackles issues such as intellectual pluralism, gender, the ethics of political participation, human rights, nonviolence, and religious harmony. Now, what are your views on religion, culture, and human rights, given that there are so many human rights abuses and violations occurring in many countries under the pretext of religious practice and belief?
Yeah, I mean, again, the link between human rights and religion and culture is a complex one. But there should be no necessarily contradiction between the values of that, the peaceful values, collaborative values, diversity values that are in all faith group, and between what the Charter of Human Rights calls for in Geneva and also after that. The problem is not in the faith itself, in many cases, but the problem is the way the governance system, the cultural and the religious governance system, is being applied. Human rights, there are many, lots of research, as we indicated in that publication. There are many publications and research that says human rights values are compatible with Islam and compatible with the faith and with the hermeneutic of wasatiyya or middle ground in Islam. So if we adopt the wasatiyya, the middle ground, the moderate voice of Islam, which is the mainstream, then there is no contradiction between the human rights values and their application, and between the faith, if it was Islam or Christianity or Judaism, in that context. However, if we adopt the hermeneutics of exclusion, hermeneutics of superiority over other faith, hermeneutics of superiority of certain ways of worshiping over other group, within the same faith or outside, then we will have a contradiction. Then we will have a clash between the so-called Universal Human Rights Declaration or the Universal Human Rights Declaration and the hermeneutics of exclusion or discrimination or even the justification of the use of violence to spread the call of your own faith. Like Daesh or like Jabhat al-Nusra or Al-Qaeda has done in the, or Boko Haram has done in the last 10-15 years. That hermeneutic contradict with human rights, contradict with the basic values of the Declaration of Human Rights. But you know, fortunately, this is not the mainstream hermeneutics of Islam. On the other hand, I must say also that there are certain application of the Human Rights Declaration that's done in Western society that also abusive of the basic right of Muslims and or of religious people, Christian, Muslim, Jews, and that secular way of total separation between religion and between the governance, religion, and the public life, basically confining religion to the closet, is itself a source that of discontent, of contradiction with other cultures and other ways of living. As we started this conversation an hour ago, an hour and a half ago, we established that religious identity is important. Therefore, we cannot deny its existence. At the same time, we should not take our own religious identity and value and impose it on other people, because that become, in both cases, I think, you have a violation of a human right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Mohamed Abu Nimer, a professor at the School of International Service, American University, and a senior advisor at the King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz International Center for Interreligious and Intercultural Center. Dr. Mohamed Abu Nimer, thank you very much for your scholarly and practical contributions to the field of peace and conflict resolution, interfaith and intrafaith dialogue. And most especially, thank you for joining us on the ICM radio program, Let's Talk About It, to share your wealth of knowledge with us on interreligious conflict resolution. We hope to have you again, most probably at your free time, for another episode of the ICM radio program. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners and supporters. Remember, you can always come back to listen to this very important conversation on our website, www.isommediation.org. In addition to listening to the podcast, you can also get involved. There are many ways through which you can get involved in our organization. You can join the movement by signing up for the membership, by registering for our upcoming events, especially our international conference on ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building, taking place in New York on November the 2nd, 2016. You can also register to participate in our training programs. We also have forums on our website where you can share your views, interact with others, and post your comments. Join us next time for another episode of the ICM radio program. As always, I am Basil Ogoji. Thanks for listening.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ICERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever. Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.